Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 24th, 2001. In the Creekside room this morning is Christy Traina. Today's session number is 2001-02, and it's titled Staking Our Claim, Lifestyle and Consumption. Let's listen in.
I'm Christy Traina. I teach at Northwestern University and I'm doing a series on theology, ethics, and ecology. Yesterday we did a session on the Green Bible, places in Scripture that people have looked for advice on how to relate to the world, and places that people are now looking, different places in Scripture, for advice on how to relate to the world. Today we're talking about our impact and our small choices that we make every day on the world around us. And we have the enormous good fortune of having with us as a guest in the village, so she's an extra volunteer because she's paying to be here and she's still teaching, Annette Olson, who is a marine ecologist who studies marine plants and invertebrate animals and their relationships to each other, and has also done a great amount of work on non-native species and the introduction of non-native species into our environment and why we do that and what effect it has and whether and when it's advisable. So we're taking special advantage of her presence today to focus on that particular issue. I just want to say a couple of framing things before she starts, and you'll all be invited to contribute as well. One of them is that I think many of us, simply by being here, have made particular choices about lifestyle. In other words, we've started to think about how we can have a little bit less negative impact on the world around us, or some positive impact, even ecologically and in terms of justice. Okay, and so many of us have simplified in some way. We take our religious values into account when we decide what to buy, what kind of work to do, how much work to do. But within those lifestyle choices, there are still very many discrete choices that we make that require a great deal of background education before we know whether we're making the right ones. For instance, one of them might be, do I buy organic vegetables from 1,500 miles away or locally grown vegetables that might not be organic? Which one would have the lesser negative impact on my environment when we're talking about gas versus pesticides, right? These are some of the choices. And we quite frankly can't do all the research we need to make them. But when we begin in very small ways, in particular areas, to learn about the small choices we make within our larger lifestyle, then we can even be more effective in our work in the world. The second thing is that there are several kinds of questions that we ask about the impact of our choices on the environment. When it comes to plants, there are kind of three regions that we might want to consider and talk about as we go along today. Non-native plants are an issue, first of all, agriculturally. What kinds of plants cause problems for farmers, make it difficult for them to do their work, right? So that's one region of questions about plants. That's completely anthropocentric, self-interested, you know, for us. Another region of questions is, what is the impact of the plant on the ecosystem on which we're dependent? Maybe it doesn't cause any problems for someone who's growing soybeans, but it might destroy a plant that supports an animal that keeps our ecosystem healthy that we rely on, right? Or it might grow up a tree and kill the tree, whatever it is that we need to keep our ecosystem healthy for us. Then there's a third set of questions. What does that plant do to the environment that is completely independent of us? If there's a mountain that doesn't have very much to do with us ecologically, but a plant might upset, a plant might take over and wipe out some kind of vegetation that is essential for deer or essential for some other animal that we want to, that has a right to live in that environment, has lived in that environment for a long time. How much do we weigh that kind of impact when we're talking about the impact of non-native plants? So those are some layers of thinking and values that we can talk about. I'd like to turn things over for the next while to Annette. We'll be having a discussion later on all together and or during her presentation, and at the end I'm going to save about 5 minutes to share with you some resources that you might want to take a look at when you go home that will help you continue to discover the surprising impact of little tiny choices on the world around us. So, Annette, thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I thank you for letting me come here. Part of the background of why I'm here is that when I came 5 years ago to Holden, I saw that a lot of non-native plants were being propagated in the gardens here. And I was concerned. My husband is also, Charlie is a terrestrial botanist, and we were concerned. And so along with our contribution that we sent after our visit here, we sent a little note saying, you know, you have non-native plants in your garden, and here are some of the reasons why you might not want to have them there. And we didn't hear back, and it wasn't an issue that was on the table at all when we were here, when we spoke. I spoke to one of the directors, and it just wasn't in consciousness at all. Well, subsequently, it turns out, I didn't want to make a total fool of myself, so I asked the directors just what was the policy, was there one now? And it turns out that, and now I'm totally going to forget her name, maybe someone else knows it, a woman who has sort of been the guiding force for the gardening here and landscaping, whose name I'll probably not remember now, but I'll put, direct you to her her book in the library. She's the author of the wildflower book, the Holden wildflower book that you can buy in the bookstore. Has done an assessment of non-native plants at Holden and made some recommendations about ones to eradicate and ones to alternatives to use in the gardens. And she also worked with the Forest Service to bring in some botanists who did a survey of the surrounding area to identify weeds. And those materials are in the back of this book. There's a lovely three-ring notebook on the table in the library room that's on your left when you go down where the reference stuff is. And it has to stay in there. But in the back of it is her report on Holden exotics and her recommendations for landscaping and things like that. So that you might like to look at that. Well, in the meantime, we decided that because the context was sort of our choices, we would broaden the discussion to think. I had suggested this topic to Christy as one that the class might want to discuss, and she invited me to come. I'm very grateful for that. But we make choices in our own gardening, and we also make choices when we're advising groups like Holden or our local government or even our national government as citizens. And so one of my goals is just to tell you some things about non-native plants and to give you some vocabulary and plant some thoughts in your head. So. Pardon? Yeah, so thank you very much. See, I told you I'd need you. So I'll just go over briefly. I have a little handout that has an outline on it. I'll start out just by showing you a little model that I drew I didn't know what ethics is because I'm an academic but of the natural science sort, so I've never formally studied ethics. Everyone thinks they know what it is, but I was worried that I would just be way out in left field, so I drew up a little model of where I think what the ethical context is of what I was talking about today. Then cover a little bit about what is natural, and here I'll introduce some vocabulary, and then talk about the roles that humans play in causing invasions of non-native plants, examine some of our values about why we plant and weed. So we both put plants into the environment, we also remove plants from the environment, and so we're making choices in doing both of those things. And then finally, talk about the actions we take in our homes and lands. So this is more forward-looking. And these last three sections are really just, I'll make a few comments and then we'll have some discussion. And maybe you can time our discussion so that we move on if I forget. So the ethical model, it was just my effort to try to figure out where the talk about nature itself might fit in the larger context of Christy's work. And when I asked her what ethics was, she said, well, given that you believe in God, then how are you going to behave in the world? And so with that in mind, I thought about
nature as a manifestation of God and how God inspires our values. And our values, at least we like to think, direct our actions. So I'm going to talk today mostly about the middle pieces of this little diagram, nature, our actions, and our values. And I didn't do a lot of biblical research to give you the nice set of biblical references that Christy did yesterday. I apologize for that.
But no, that's okay. We did that yesterday.
Okay. So I won't have any biblical references to make. So I think I'll just move right into what is natural. Probably the main vocabulary around what is natural has to do with native and non-native plants and animals. And there's a bunch of synonyms for those terms, native and non-native. And although, Christy, you may have observed this morning that I used it, I try to avoid the terms alien and exotic for non-native plants, because it actually intentionally educators sometimes use those terms to trigger xenophobia in people. So they, you know, alien invaders, mm-hmm. and that gets your attention, but it also speaks to a part of humanity that I personally don't want to reinforce. So I try to use non-native or non-indigenous, which is a more typically used among scientists, or introduced. I looked these two terms, native and exotic, actually is what I looked up in OED, the old Oxford English Dictionary. And native means born of a place, the original or usual inhabitants of a place, and said of biota, not imported or acclimatized. What was interesting to me was that born of a place actually has a connotation of bondage. Native, in the root of native, means like the servant of a landholder, which I had never known. I'm an etymological freak, so I was very excited to see that new piece of information. And then non-native means belonging to another country, foreign or alien. There's some other terms that are often thrown around regarding the purpose of introduction. So people will say cultivars when they mean plants that are introduced for cultivation, either in agriculture, horticulture, or silviculture. There are a lot of control agents. So people introduce plants or animals to solve problems. And so they're biological control, erosion control. And an interesting example of erosion control is one that my husband has recently uncovered. The Wenatchee National Forest seeds areas where wildfire has occurred with a mix of grasses and clover that fix nitrogen, stop erosion, and occupy the soil so that the soil doesn't all wash away while the native plants are getting established. And these things eventually die out, but they may alter the course of natural succession, in other words, the natural sequence of plants that might occur on the site. So there's a good reason for using that non-native mix, because native seeds are in short supply. So something that some people are doing, both as volunteers and now in small businesses, is to develop the infrastructure, the seed supply of native plants to use in these kind of applications. If you need to seed thousands and thousands of hectares of land, you just can't buy that much native seed to do it with. And then, of course, there are the accidental or unintentional introductions, and a term that's often used is hitchhikers. So a lot of times, introduced plants are a problem because of their own behavior, but because they bring with them something that's undesirable. And an example that I learned about at Holden is that there's vinca. The little periwinkle is planted in some of the beds as ground cover, and it's a little bit invasive, but up here it's too harsh, I think, for it to be a real problem. But it happens to carry with it a disease of that will affect the native lilies. So there was a recommendation in this policy document that I was telling you about to eradicate the vinca because it brings this hitchhiker with it. And then, of course, there are a score of words having to do with describing the spread and impacts of non-native plants. escaped, invasive, weed or weedy, nuisance, pest, noxious. And again, these are more value judgments, and when we start talking about values, you'll see that a weed is in the eye of a beholder. There were two other terms I wanted to just mention, and that was somewhere here between native and non-native. There are a couple of others, there's a gray area. Scientists call plants or animals that, whose origins we're not sure of, they call them cryptogenic. In other words, we don't know for sure whether they were here prior to human occupation, say, of the Western Hemisphere, and or of European occupation of the Western Hemisphere, or of European occupation of Oregon. Or Washington. I guess we're in Washington now. I just moved from Oregon, so I'm a little confused. And then there's another set here, which, as a scientist, I would make a strong distinction about, but many people don't, which are what are called naturalized aliens. In other words, these are in our environment. We're not planning to do anything about them. And, in fact, we don't think that they're a good thing. And, again, that's in the eye of the beholder, whether they are good or not.
That term's also used for people, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's, I mean, I never thought of that.
Just to help me understand those two terms, could you give me an example of each?
Of cryptogenic?
A cryptogenic and a naturalized alien?
Yes. There's a saltgrass, Spartina alterniflora, which is the foundation of the salt marshes on the East Coast. And it's well known to be a problem invader in Australia, in South Africa, in Europe, on the west coast of the U.S. Because it takes over mudflats. Any kind of environment that didn't have a big hefty marsh plant like that gets it. It gets in. And There are some other less common species of Spartina that we're actually not sure whether they occurred here prior to Western contact, because a lot of plants were transported in the solid ballast of wooden sailing vessels, and so we don't actually know for sure if some of the Spartina species got to the West Coast when the early explorers were here or whether they were native. There's a known native Spartina in California, and that's documented from archaeological evidence, but the other Spartinas that occur in the Northwest are not as common and don't show up in the archaeological record, so we just don't know. A naturalized alien. Some people might think that the oxeye daisy that you see growing alongside the roads and up some of the trails is just part of the environment, or the foxglove. But those are both accidental. Actually, I think foxglove was introduced intentionally for medicine, but it's accidentally here. The oxeye daisy probably was a decorative introduction, but I'm not sure how it got actually to this place. But most of the time, people don't consider managing them, although there are recommendations to manage them at Holden from the Forest Service and in this document that I mentioned. So the little table there is just to show you some examples from familiar plant families that you might find either growing in the wild or under cultivation. That's the row headings there on the left, and that are either native or non-native to the Western Hemisphere. We have a wild cucumber that grows at least on the west side, and I'm not sure whether it gets into the mountains on the east side or not. Do you, honey? Yeah. And then the squash is a cultivated native to the Western Hemisphere. It's actually endemic to the Western Hemisphere, so there are no non-native squash family plants either in the wild or under cultivation because they come from here originally. The beech pea in the pea family is native. Some vetches have escaped from cultivation and become a problem in the wild. Peanuts are native to the Western Hemisphere. Soybeans aren't. So that's a family that's all over the Northern Hemisphere. but it has representatives in different places. There's the grasses, corn under cultivation here, oats that are cultivated here but come from Europe. Idaho fescue is an important range grass, and cheap grass is an introduced species that degrades ranges. And then some berries. I have to say that the black cat raspberry is actually a hybrid of a native berry and a cultivated berry.
The Himalayan blackberry is an invasive thing in the west coast of Oregon.
Yeah.
Do we know how it got there? It's interesting to note that it's not native. Do we know how it arrived there?
I don't actually know the story of its arrival. It's possible that it was initially introduced in for agricultural reasons. People thought it would be, you know, fun to eat. It certainly is. But certainly its wide distribution now is via bird dispersal. So I don't know the point of introduction. Do you, honey?
No, I think that's the case of many of these plants. It could be that they were introduced at a single point, and it could be that they were dispersed.
Yeah. It varies a lot depending on the plant, and I don't happen to know the terrestrial literature. I know more about aquatic plants, being a marine ecologist. But it turns out that the policy environment is all developed for terrestrial plants, and there is no real well-developed policy for, and there's good policy for aquatic plants that are agricultural pests or navigational pests, but there's virtually nothing for aquatic marine plants. Nothing is developed specifically to deal with their unique traits.
More questions?
Yeah.
We have in Minnesota now a very serious invasion of milfoil,
mm-hmm.
which is killing lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes over the lake, uses up the, does it use up the oxygen? No.
Yeah, it does. It does because it dies. It grows so much that it sinks to the bottom, and then the bottom becomes anoxic, and that's what kills the fish.
Right. And I don't know where that came from.
Well, again, that's one that's really hard to track because it grows vegetatively. It doesn't have to reproduce by seed. So little bits on boat trailers and boats has been a major, they call it a vector for moving them around. Yeah. It's a terrible problem, and I think it's an escaped aquarium plant. I think that's where how it got into the environment. And so we're about to move on to our role in human actions, pathways for invasion, and where some of these questions have touched on this. Were there more questions before I plunge into this next piece? This little diagram is one that I've used in teaching and actually in my research to describe the process of invasion, and it has a few features that are intentional. You notice that not all the blobs are the same size and not all the arrows are the same size, and I wanted to explain a little bit about that. The blobs are sets of species. So when you start in a source population, say in another country or another state, you have a whole suite of species that are there, and some of them are native and some of them are non-native, and we're going to take a us-centric view then and say that some kind of process of transport occurs and they end up being here, and not all of them survive the transport, so the blob gets smaller. There are fewer that end up in your place than started out in their homeland. Those live colonists may or may not be able to establish and reproduce. And so the establishment step, again, is another filter, and you get a smaller blob of species that you would then say are invaders. In other words, they're living and reproducing in the native habitat. Then, at any point, these invaders, or even the live colonists, may be subsequently spread to other areas. So, for instance, we may have brought the ox-eye daisy to Lucerne and planted it. The miners might have brought it as a decorative plant. I don't know that this happened. I'm making it up. And then it subsequently spread to Holden. That could be one way that happened. Not all of those invaders, though, are problems for us, or the problems that we recognize.
And so the set of those that then become problem species or weeds or whatever you want to call them is even smaller. But you notice that as we're going down this pathway of invasion, that the arrows are getting bigger and bigger, and that's because the proportion of those species that are likely to cause problems gets greater and greater, and the costs of managing them get greater and greater. So one of the conventional wisdom of non-native plant management is that you get a lot more effectiveness if you can prevent invasions than if you're going to try to control them. So if you think about controlling the oxeye daisy around Holden, and you see every place that you see it growing, you think, that would take a lot of effort. The other thing that increases as you go along this gradient, or it changes, but it's in a decreasing manner, is the resources that are available. So the level of government that typically addresses transport issues is federal or state, whereas those that deal with establishment or with responding to impacts is typically at a lower level, either state or county, municipality, or private individuals. So it's us who own, work with, and depend on the land who are also responsible to deal with these problems, but the difficulty of dealing with them is greater and greater because our resources are both less and more diffuse. So rather than tell you a whole bunch about transport, I thought perhaps it would be interesting to just think about different ways that we might transport. I should have put spread with transport. I see I made a little typo here, so this should say transport and spread. I wanted to group together, and then establishment and impacts. So we've mentioned a couple of ways that we intentionally or inadvertently transport non-native species. We could decide to plant them someplace. We could order them on the internet from anywhere and put them in the ground anywhere we want to. We also accidentally transport things, for instance, on boat trailers or things. How do you know about ways that we might be possibly bringing in or spreading non-native species into Holden?
People need to check their socks, for instance, or the bottoms of their shoes. Recently we were hiking, and I can't remember where it was in the last year, where we were told very specifically, check your shoes and socks, please don't bring seeds in on the trail, because there were weeds, right? Non-native species that they were trying to prevent the spread of. And I can't remember where we were, though. Remember?
Flower picking? Sometimes kids or grown-ups even will pick wild flowers and carry them along and then maybe drop them someplace else.
There certainly isn't much possibility of any vehicles there. We have to come up here by boat.
Yeah.
So we're not going to drive in and carry anything under the undercarriage.
Yeah. But right now, I would say that's a very low probability. I'd say that when mining was occurring, it was a high probability because of the amount of traffic. That's another issue is, what is the probability? When you're managing a non-native species, one of the things you want to look at is try to identify the high probability vectors, the things that are likely to carry a non-native species, and then focus on those.
Yeah. This is maybe as a long shot, but those of us who do composting, we get shipments of food from exotic places, that is to say, far distance. And then, of course, there's some seed material left over that could be in the compost that local animals could get, which could then take off in different directions locally, do something that climatologically was similar to where it came from, might even start to take off.
Mm-hmm. That actually happens with tomatoes, at least in the lowlands of Puget Sound, where dredge wells are just deposited. Tomato seeds pass through the healing vat, and can live for quite a long time in the marine environment, it turns out. Mm-hmm. And when they dredge in the marine environment, and they happen to have built a park in Seattle out of dredging spoils, and the park when it was initially built, was totally colonized with tomatoes. So yeah, we can bring things in with food. We could also bring other pests in, you know, like insect pests, for instance, with food, and diseases.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that at all threatens the lake? I mean, it's such a pure, clear water down there.
I think in areas, you know, I know they're monitoring the water quality because of the amount of housing development, which is all dependent on septic. So leaking septic systems alter lake quality, and that can sometimes result in localized blooms. I would think the whole lake itself is probably pretty immune. And I haven't seen any blooms of anything. I haven't heard anything or read anything about blooms of pest aquatic plants here. But there is the possibility that, especially in the shallower basin, boat traffic could bring that in. And in fact, with the zebra mussel, that is one of the major foci of educational efforts, is to prevent the zebra mussel from being transported among lakes. And there's a big Millennium Project that's trying to keep the zebra mussel from appearing west of the Continental Divide by intercepting boat traffic, trailer boat traffic.
We may be getting into establishment here, but I think you're bringing up a really good point, which is not only do we need to keep species from being transported, but then we need to watch out that we don't create environments that will be especially hospitable to other species. And I'm thinking of creating environments. Agriculture sometimes creates environments that make it easy for what we consider noxious pests to grow, or, you know, the idea of creating an environment where it's easy for an algal bloom to happen. The algae are going to be there, but you don't have to have the septic septic leaks that create the food for the algae.
Right. And so that's a case where you actually can have native species that become pests, where there's a lot of nutrient input from humans. Something like a cattail marsh can develop, which is not a very diverse environment. It's good for many fewer animal species, for instance. So there's something becomes a native pest. So that is really in the area of establishment. When we change the environment to make things more hospitable for establishment to occur.
Interestingly, I think in 2 weeks we had a madness about a week and a half ago. The person who read or reading, I don't remember the book, about he's talking about sowing good seed in the story of this sower. But he read from a naturalist book about how every time this person took a walk, he took seeds and threw them out, and how we should do that. And it's interesting that it was really just looked on as kind of helping things grow and find good soil, but I was really just making it sound like, you know, took some seeds up to copper basin and so on.
You used to have a story about that, a little one.
Yeah, I was working for the Nature Conservancy many years ago, and one of our botanists had been doing a survey up in North Cascades National Park and came upon someone who was riding a horse that was packed with bags of wildflower mix, and this person was distributing it along the trail. And you yourself might, for instance, be given a gift of, we were given a gift of butterfly mix, and it had in it something that I don't want to ever introduce intentionally to my yard, morning glory. We're still trying to get rid of it. So yeah, you do need to become a wise consumer when you look at these things. This might be getting a little bit ahead, but when you're thinking about educating others, people often have very good intentions, and so their values are in the right place, but the information they have is not adequate or complete. All right, did you have a question back there? A comment?
Well, just why would a packager put that kind of thing? That's a pretty flat-eyed puzzle.
Well, I think that, you know, you're coming to a point that I think is really important. Educating the consumer is something to do, but as Christy pointed out, as consumers, we have so many choices to make, and there's so many things to be educated about, that we can be engaged in a very strong effort to learn what we need to know, but what the people we need to get to are the packagers, the seed catalogs, and You know, those who control distribution points so that we can intercept the process earlier. I mean, it's that's the prevention rather than the control that we need to do. And there are people in the field of non-native plants and animals who are working with distributors. As I mentioned earlier, the aquarium trade has been the source of a large number of introductions of non-native plants and animals.
What trade is
that? Aquarium. And educating the aquarium dealers themselves, and also then providing product packaging that says, you know, please do not return this to nature, because the nature here doesn't want it. Don't dump it in your local stream. But, you know, people with very good intentions do things that are not very helpful for the environment, and we all do that until we learn something different. So product packaging, you know, educating suppliers are important strategies.
There's another issue, you know, you're talking about making a hospitable environment. There's also the issue now in terms of genetically modified organisms, especially with agriculture. I know in Saskatchewan with canola, Monsanto has modified canola seeds so that it you can plant the seed and then you can put on herbicide called Roundup and it kills everything except the canola, which will grow. Well, that's great, and then you harvest that, but of course in harvesting there are still seeds left behind. So let's say the next year you plant wheat, well, all that canola is out there and you can't knock it out. And so basically what you have done is you have made
a
canola, you have made a new weed, you've made a seed that, you know, you can't kill. And so now what do you do? Because other than almost pulling it out by hand, there's no way you can eradicate this canola.
I want to point out, too, that in a sense, then, Monsanto has consigned everyone who plants the canola seed to growing it in perpetuity, right? Because you either let the field go fallow or you just have to plant canola because that's the only thing you can put in that field, I would imagine. I don't know if that's what's actually happening.
Well, that's why they now want the terminator gene, so that the seeds aren't viable, and then you have to buy the next
one. Precisely. That's one of the big areas of research.
It's sort of like agricultural addiction.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. I don't know if the case was in the news here, but there was a farmer who, you know, in Saskatchewan who didn't want to use the Monsanto seed, but the seeds were blowing into his field and they took over. And Monsanto sent their police out and said, "You're using our seed, and so you have to pay for it. You need to pay for the seed." And it was a big court case over it, and the farmer said, "You know, that I didn't want the seed. It came in and took over. You know, how can I be responsible for that?" And he lost. And it's being the farmer lost. The farmer lost.
Sorry.
What are we doing now?
Oh, we have about 15 minutes.
Well, we've been talking a bit about our values, which isn't surprising because we're thinking ahead, I can see. One thing I did want to get to was just some of the impacts of non-indigenous species, and I think the one that we've been kind of talking around is things that have socioeconomic impacts. So the kind of vicious cycles that people get into. The weeds that grow in the agricultural ditches are facilitated by the nutrients applied to the agricultural land. And in California, it runs into the tens of millions of dollars a year to control aquatic weeds in the agricultural ditches. It's a big, big problem. We lose ecosystem services when weeds choke a natural and man-made waterways, when they degrade the quality of rangeland, as I mentioned earlier, the cheatgrass, which is unpleasant for cattle to eat because it pokes their faces, and they selectively graze then on the native plants, which get reduced in abundance, and then their little paws or hooves poking holes in the soil make a nice environment for spreading cheatgrass. Well, cheatgrass is just the first of the widespread bad range weeds in the West, and now we're dealing with a whole bunch of new ones that are, there's just wave after wave of range degrading plants that have occupied the West, being again facilitated sometimes by overgrazing and their relative noxiousness or unpleasantness to the grazers that we put out there. There are very few cases documented where non-indigenous species actually cause the extinction of native species, but they cause what some scientists call ecological extinction, where the abundances are radically reduced. So for instance, if you happen to live in the Willamette Valley in Puget Trough, I had a dream a couple of months ago, actually, in which I was weeping and weeping because I was saying, I have never seen the native vegetation of this place. Because in the Puget Trough, except for the shrubs and trees, virtually every herb, most herbs and virtually every grass you see is not native, even in unquote undisturbed areas. So the bike trail along, through Seattle, the Burt Gilman Trail, there was a little set of note cards made up, the wildflowers of Burt Gilman Trail, and of the 8 flowers that were portrayed, every single one of them was a non-native plant. So they radically alter environments, and we really don't know how they operated before, many times. And of course, there are the wilderness values that Christy alluded to. But sometimes our values about what we want to plant and what we want to eradicate come into conflict, for instance, with the erosion control example that I gave you. We really don't want all the soil to wash off the hillsides when we have these massive and man-caused fires, but do we have the native seed source to seed these places? We often don't. One thing that's happening here at Holden, which is interesting and I think very benign, is the value of historic preservation. Christy brought up this morning the seed savers who are trying to preserve historic non-hybrid seeds. And here at Holden, we have the propagation of the irises that were grown here initially by the miners' wives. And they're the subject of this beautiful photo display in that notebook I told you about in the library. It's really lovely. She's put together photos with the names of all the different irises that she's propagated and retrieved from oblivion. So we often will deliberately plant non-native things. Her recommendations are at Holden to replace some of the non-native plants that are in the gardens with less invasive varieties. So for instance, I noticed that the oxbow daisy for most part is being removed from the gardens, and the Shasta daisy, which doesn't spread very easily, is replacing it where you'd like to have some daisies in your garden. So you can make those kinds of choices. Even as relatively well-informed botanists, we decided to plant some decorative grasses and sedges in our yard, and we got a whole bunch of really nasty weeds because they're really invasive. They reproduce by seed, and we filled our garden up, and I'm constantly pulling these little things. So inquiring into the invasiveness of plants when you purchase them or choose to put them in a new environment is really worth doing.
Well, our lawn in Bloomington, Minnesota is full of miscellaneous grasses,
mm-hmm.
and weeds, and I'm told that they come primarily from birds.
Uh-huh.
We have birds in the lawn, and they get dropping. I guess that's really, and I don't know, there's nothing we can do about it. We almost have to dig up our lawn and reseed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in cases like that, a lot of it is airborne, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's that?
Airborne.
I don't know how.
There isn't anything you can do about airborne dispersal of seeds.
No, you are in an environment in the Midwest that I'm not very familiar with. I understand that you have storm-driven transport, so that even things as big as frogs and fish can be moved around. And we out here never think about airborne fish.
We try not to.
So the last thing I wanted to make sure to just lay out is a sort of set of options. We can actually do sort of develop ecosystem services even within our own gardens. So in Seattle, for instance, there's backyard wildlife habitat registry. You can register your garden as backyard wildlife habitat. There's guidelines for what you want to have planted there to improve the habitat for wildlife, and it's all focused on native species. Two sets of definitions I wanted to put up. One is the idea of what is sustainability. Charlie pointed out to me this morning that planting native can often mean that you have a more sustainable garden or yard. And one of them is that you want, one of the principles is that you minimize subsidies.
What's that second word? Subsidy?
I haven't gotten to it yet. Sustainable, I'm saying minimize, and here's subsidy, yes. So, water, fertilizer, pesticides, when you plant native, you can often put in plants that don't need as much support from you as comparable exotics, although there aren't always good alternatives. And I'm not a real native plant activist in terms of gardens, because I enjoy a lot of non-native plants, and I think the beauty aspect of non-native plants is something that we all want to keep in our gardens. The other thing you want to do is to minimize the exports, like a fertilizer. And sometimes you really do have to fertilize to keep something non-native going in your yard. The other thing I wanted to mention was sort of the range of possibilities for managing. And I mentioned earlier prevention. So don't put something in unless you know fairly sure that it's not going to cause a problem. Eradication, which is almost never possible. In other words, the complete local extinction of something that you've decided causes a problem. Population control, this is what's done in agriculture. No one ever truly eradicates agricultural pests. They keep them at what they call the economic threshold. So where the economic damage threshold, I'm sorry, I forgot a word there, where they keep the damage below a certain level based on how much it's costing them in terms of the value of the product, the control of the pest. Another thing we often do is manage the impacts. That's not so, I'm not going to remember a good example for plants, but sometimes we aren't able to do anything even about the population size, but we might be able to change the season that we do something, so we're essentially adapting to the presence of something, of a non-native species that's causing a problem. So this is about the time that we would want to turn it over to you again.
Right, but I would like to see if anyone has particular questions or stories to share of management or the opposite in your own situations or suggestions to make. Because this is one place where we can't do everything, but we can begin in one place, right? With one habit or with one plant that we're using.
I had one that I told you about this morning that I'll share, and that is the ox-eye daisy is not something that we could eradicate from Holden, but it grows along the trails. And while I wouldn't recommend that every person go out and pull up what they think is an ox-eye daisy growing along the trails, one approach that could be taken in a sort of Holden-centric view would be on the trails going into the wilderness to have trained people who could identify those plants and pull them back
often when you can't eradicate a source population, but you have a valued resource somewhere else, you can. That's what population control can mean, is pulling something back toward that source population.
Right. Pull in the edges all the time so that the edges aren't leaping forward sort of frog-like over each other.
And exponentially, right.
Exactly, so that you can at least control.
I don't know whether it's native or non-native, but I had a home we call Lily Valley in my farm, and it spreads through the root system.
Uh-huh.
It just takes over the whole bed. So I finally got rid of it. Then, but I still wanted it. So I put a plastic barrel in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And planted it inside the barrel, and it's confined.
It does stay in, yeah.
And I suppose that could be applied to others that spread, certainly not if they spread through the seeds, but through anything that spreads through the roots. It's a good way to confine them.
Daylilies.
Mint is another one that's good to use a container to confine.
Anybody want some? That's why I have. At this point, because I know we need to end in time, I want to thank you, Annette, and Charlie also. Helfern has made a big contribution, although you didn't say much today, to the presentation this morning, for sharing your great knowledge with us, because being an ethicist, I know which questions to ask, but I don't always know what specific answers to give when it gets down to brass tacks. And so thank you so much for being with us. I have a couple of things to pass around. One is just the general list that I've made up for reading this week. If you're interested, it will serve the double purpose of acting as bug repellent because some leaked on it in my suitcase. So if you're interested, I'll pass that around. The second thing I want to pass around are a few resources to check out when you get home on ecological impact. There's some great websites if you are a teacher or have children especially. There's something called the Great Green Web Game, which is very child-friendly. The North American Association of Environmental Education is an incredible resource for education at every level, from kindergarten to postgraduate. And there's something called the Personal Environmental Impact Calculator, which comes from the University of Wisconsin, that can give you some surprising answers about, for instance, whether you really ought to drive or take the bus or take the train in particular circumstances. And it turns out that what you thought you ought to do is not always the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very, very helpful and gives some nice suggestions for reducing consumption.
I've heard that about disposable diapers, that there are environmental circumstances in which using disposable has less impact.
Right. And then there's also the EMS News Service, which if you want a daily dose of environmental news, is great. Some of the things that are on it are industry-produced, but by and large, you'll get news there that you won't get in your local paper. And it's a great way to stay up to date in just a few minutes a day, skimming through the titles in that. And they're all online articles, so that's really helpful as well. There are a couple of books listed at the bottom. They're also on the other sheet that are wonderful resources to read if you want to know something about the impact you're having. Thank you very, very much for coming and spending some of this sunny, gorgeous, hikeable morning. And thanks to Annette and to Charles.
Do we have time for the bonus blessing?
Yes, and we have a blessing. I'm sorry, Annette would like to suggest that we finish with the blessing that's on the sheet, which she's going to read because I'm not.
Well, this is from my daughter, and she didn't write it, but she learned it at school. So we speak the first part, and then I'll sing the end now, and then we can sing it together. So it goes, blessings on the blossom, blessings on the fruit, blessings on the leaf and stem, and blessings on the root. Shall we begin the spoken then?
Okay. Kind hearts are the garden, kind thoughts are the roots, kind deeds are the blossoms, kind words are the fruits.
Blessings on the blossom, blessings on the fruit, blessings on the leaf and stem, and blessings on the root.